Hi everyone, welcome. We're very pleased to have Lampros Lampou, who has completed his PhD from Stanford in 2017, working with Lenny Susskind, and has since done postdocs at MIT and UBC, where he is currently. And today he will tell us about emergent time and the black hole interior. Lampros, please go ahead.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me here. It's always a pleasure to be considered by Perimeter and interacting with the group. Yeah, so I will give you a summary of a program that I have been developing with a number of different collaborators over the past 3 years. In fact, the last installment in this long-term project was published last night. It's on archive now with Daniel Zafaris and Jan de Boer. And it's the contents of this last paper I will mostly be summarizing at a sufficiently high level so that I can kind of communicate the basic physical ideas we want to communicate. So the topic, there's kind of two seemingly distinct topics, which I will try to sort of merge and explain how they're connected. One is the concept of time in quantum gravity. And more precisely, the notion of time that an observer that is part of a quantum mechanical universe experiences in the rest frame. And then the other question is a much more technical problem. It's the reconstruction of the black hole interior. How can we define observables behind black hole horizons and address all sorts of puzzles that black holes come with? So I will slowly and progressively make these concepts more clear and more precise as we go and explain how they're connected. So, okay. So first of all, time. Time in a universe that is that has dynamical geometry is a gauge transformation. Of course, it's not a physical degree of freedom, unless there is some kind of asymptotic boundary or asymptotic region where we tame the fluctuations of space-time, and there we can define an asymptotic clock and an asymptotic Hamiltonian correspondingly. And in many of the examples of quantum gravity that we have non-perturbative control over, it is precisely this asymptotic Hamiltonian that becomes the microscopic Hamiltonian. For example, in ADS-CFT, which will be the context of this talk, this asymptotic Hamiltonian is identified non-perturbatively with a CFT Hamiltonian. Now, this is a useful notion of time, but there is another one, kind of more phenomenologically relevant one, which is the notion of time that we experience as observers inside the system. If you have some semi-classical observer inside this ADS universe, it has a proper time, and this is a physically meaningful notion of time because it is relational. It describes the change of the universe relative to the state of the observer. And this is a more murky notion, and we don't really have good control over how to define the generator of that evolution, the evolution in this internal frame. So it's also not something that we get to decide. Once you specify your microscopic system, the CFT, the algebra of the CFT, and the Hamiltonian of the CFT, you have no extra freedom to select what the internal observer will experience. This is determined somehow via some kind of principle by the laws of the boundary conformal field theory. This principle is what we're after. How to understand, this is what I call emergent time in this framework. So I want to emphasize that although this does sound like a philosophical question, and it is part of the appeal of this question to me, it's also a very technical one. It has a very kind of precise objective. Because you see, the big question in ADS-CFT is the so-called program of bulk reconstruction. How do we start from the set of observables that we have good control over at the boundary, CFT local operators, and sort of use them to define the hologram, the degrees of freedom that describe local fields in the bulk? And there are, of course, many approaches to that problem. That people have come up with, but they all come with various shortcomings. And the ideal would be to have some kind of principle to really just push these operators from the boundary inwards via some kind of CFT-first principled way so that we can understand what CFT physics gives rise to the hologram. So if I give you enough kind of, if I give you the rules, the CFT rules for defining that time evolution I keep talking about, then there is a precise method of taking boundary observables and simply propagate them along in falling world lines into the bulk. So this is kind of like a richer, perhaps more deep approach to bulk reconstruction, which comes with significant advantages. Because one, the Achilles heel of basically all reconstruction techniques that people have developed so far run into trouble when you try to push them behind black hole horizons. On the other hand, if we're able to make progress in the question I'm asking here, then the black hole interiors are just a finite amount of proper time away for any observer that falls in. That includes any point behind the horizon, including the singularity. So we can start technically asking questions about the properties of the interiors, the singularity, and so on. And it is these two points that I just mentioned, the problem of bulk reconstruction and the black hole interior, that I will make comments on in this talk. There's a third point, there's a third kind of reason to consider this kind of internal clocks, and that's because there are systems where no asymptotic clock is available to begin with, like, for example, the Sider cosmologies. Even semi-classically, there is no good clock there. And therefore, one may wonder, you know, maybe the only available notions of dynamics in quantum gravity in the Sider space is internal, perhaps of the sort I'm discussing here. Okay, so my goal now is to slowly now start building a story. I will tell you a story with enough rules that to actually, by the end of this talk, you will have enough rules to actually sit down and technically write down questions about the black hole interior, like the ones I'm discussing here. So the very high level overview of what I'm about to tell you is the following. So we'll work in ADS CFT, and I will explain to you how to select some subsystem of the theory to be your observer, your frame of reference. Now, not any subsystem will be equally good. We need to be clever enough to pick an appropriate subsystem with enough properties and that will be useful for us, and I will explain how to do that. And once we do that, then I will explain what the principles are for evolving the universe relative to that frame of reference, that internal observer that I'm talking about. And then we'll use it to see behind black holes and ask very concrete questions about the features of the black hole interior. So that's the plan. Okay, so before diving into the details of the proposal, I want to take a moment to illustrate all the mathematical concepts we will use in the most elementary example possible. And then we'll just simply map them to the problem we care about with some extra work. So the simplest example that showcases all the concepts is just take QFT in flat space, just two-dimensional Minkowski space for maximal simplicity. There's clearly a few natural notions of time associated to this system. There's the global kind of Minkowski time. This is the time of some inertial observer that I picked. And this is a dynamical input in the theory. We specify the degrees of freedom, and then we have a Hamiltonian, and that's the clock. But there's another notion of time that's also natural, which is the notion of time associated to a Rindler observer, a constantly accelerated observer. And the Hamiltonian of this observer is the boost. Now, this boost doesn't need to be separately defined, as I said before. Once we have the system specified, the boost, there's a precise procedure, another procedure for constructing the boost. But it will be useful for our purposes and for generalizing it to the less trivial case we have in mind to rephrase a little bit the definition of the boost and kind of articulate in a different way. So here's the way that will be useful for us. An accelerated observer that, let's say, moves in this right Rindler wedge only has access to a subset of the degrees of freedom of the theory. And these are the degrees of freedom that are sort of within this right causal wedge. Now, it is it's a statement about algebraic quantum field theory that if we are given a state of a QFT and a subalgebra, then algebraic quantum field theory defines for us a preferred kind of flow, a unitary flow, which is called the modular flow. There exists a Hermitian operator, K0, I will denote it here, which is called the modular Hamiltonian, which generates an automorphism of the subalgebra of interest. Now, this modular flow in general is a quantum mechanical type of flow. It doesn't have any particularly nice properties, except when the state of interest is the vacuum of a relativistic QFT. Then the modular Hamiltonian coincides with the boost that generates the time of the inertial of the accelerated observer. So once again, for every state and a given subalgebra, there exists a modular Hamiltonian, but for general states, that's not a geometric transformation, but for special states, like for example, the vacuum of a relativistic QFT, it is. And we'll take this to be sort of the more formal way of defining that clock. And we will now try to take this idea and map it into ADS-CFT in some particular way. Okay, so to summarize the statement, because we will get to an identical statement later on, an identically looking statement, the Lorentz boost or the Rindler clock is generated by the modular Hamiltonian of the state that minimizes the global energy. Okay. So back to ADS-CFT. How do we make progress? How do we take this idea of this notion of internal time and kind of embed it in quantum gravity? Okay, so what am I showing you here? Here, the bottom part of the figure is a Euclidean path integral that prepares some state that you may like in ADS. So it's a CFT path integral. It may have sources on it and so on that prepares some kind of universe you want to explore. And the top part is sort of the time evolution of this universe, the Lorentzian continuation of it. Now, if you want to, the most obvious type of probe of the universe that you may come up with is, let's introduce a little particle into the system. And that little particle will be inserted by some operator insertion in that Euclidean part of the path integral. And this will, if it's heavy enough, it will follow some kind of geodesic in the bulk. Now, this kind of probe will not be good for our purposes, doesn't have enough structure to make progress, so we'll enhance it a little bit. And the probe we'll use will actually be a small black hole. So more precisely, what we'll do is we will introduce a little wormhole. And let me explain the setup, because this will be important to keep in mind. So we'll bring an extra copy of the system, which we will refer to the reference. The properties of the reference don't matter too much, but for illustrative purposes, keep it to be, a copy of the original system. And then what we will do is, instead of acting with a single operator insertion in this Euclidean path integral, we'll act with this bilocal guy, this bilocal insertion, which I will refer to as the wormhole operator. Because what I'm doing here is I'm summing over operators on the system and the reference in a correlated way. And I'm summing over all of these operators in a particular energy window. And I'll pick this energy window to be of high enough energy to be in the black hole regime. Now this guy, so you may say, what is this state that I'm preparing with this Euclidean path integral now? Well, this state, by the thermodynamic dominance of black holes, will the dominant branch of the wave function will be a state containing a semi-classical wormhole between the system and the reference. This is just a thermodynamic argument. A few technical points here is that this black hole will take it to be a microcanonical black hole, not a canonical one. That's for technical reasons, because we can take a very nice limit of these black holes being small, smaller than the cosmological scale of this universe, smaller than LADS. But this is a technicality that I will skip for now get back to the main point. So what have we achieved? Why introduce this wormhole into the system? Well, what we have achieved by doing this is we have managed to connect with the previous elementary QFT example that I discussed before. You see, if you focus in the neighborhood of this little black hole now in this universe, the spacetime looks basically like the Rindler example we discussed before. The left Rindler wedge is this reference system that we don't really care about much. And the right wedge here is literally the entire universe that we want to explore. But the difference now is that by introducing this black hole into the system in this way, we have now a natural operator defined on our system, which is this modular Hamiltonian I referred to. There exists now a modular Hamiltonian for the algebra of the entire CFT. So this is my system CFT, and this is my reference. So by doing this entangling procedure, there's now a modular Hamiltonian associated to this CFT. It is this modular Hamiltonian we will use to define this notion of time. We're not there yet, but we're making progress towards that end. Okay. Now, why are we not done? So, as I said before, about a given background, if we are in a state, if the state in which, if the state of our universe is such that it looks like the local vacuum around this Rindler horizon, then this modular Hamiltonian is indeed geometric. It generates a Schwarzschild time translation, meaning it takes a degree of freedom at some initial moment in time and propagates them forward in time while keeping the distance from the horizon fixed. In a kind of more space-time kind of diagram, this would look like this. If this is the path that the black hole moves along, then it takes this geometric modular Hamiltonian will take this initial operator and translate it forward in this particular way, moving it inwards in the block. That is if we have the right state, if we have the vacuum state for the QFT degrees of freedom about the background that we're interested in. But I haven't told you how to choose this vacuum state, and that's kind of where the whole prescription, what the whole prescription relies on, identifying the right state. Okay, before I jump into this point, I want to pause and emphasize that there's a couple of points I wanted to appreciate in this. The first point is that this definition of this modular Hamiltonian is done entirely in terms of the CFT language. So both the insertion of the observer into the system is done via a CFT preparation of the whole state, and the definition of the operator we're using for bulk reconstruction is entirely defined in the CFT. There is no bulk input. There's bulk intuition about what these operations do in the CFT, but there is no input about what the background geometry is, what the state I'm propagating in is, if there are black holes or anything. Everything has been a CFT input as far as the technical construction goes. The second is that if I give you the rule for identifying this vacuum state for which this modular operator acts locally, then I have solved bulk reconstruction for you. Literally, any observer can have access to can be accessed by simply flowing near boundary operators we have good control over with this modular flow. Okay, so I'm going to give you now what we proposed in our paper from last night, the definition of this vacuum state is. And of course, you know, whether this is the answer or not, what time will show, but I sure hope it is. Okay, so far we have defined some state with a Euclidean path integral that contains an observer, and we've talked about the modular Hamiltonian of that state. But we also need a little bit more structure because we want to consider kind of the entire QFT Hilbert space about this background. It is inside this bigger Hilbert space that this local equilibrium state or local vacuum state I keep referring to exists. So we have to build this kind of QFT Hilbert space about that state. And this is a procedure that is well understood in ADS CFT for a while now. This subspace of the CFT is called the code subspace often, so I will be referring to it as such. And roughly speaking, it's obtained by starting with your state and acting on it with simple operators, by simple here CFT operators. By simple here, I mean low-dimension single trace operators and products of them that do not scale with n. The number of elements do not scale with n. Okay, the local equilibrium state we're looking for is some kind of state in that subspace. In particular, it's some kind of unitary transformation of this original state. Just to clarify this point, the whole point of this unitary here is to annihilate any sort of particles that fall inside our probe. Any particles that fall in our probe disturb the local vacuum, disturb the local thermal equilibrium, and make this modular flow non-geometric. So this unitary we're looking for, this U equilibrium, is the unitary that precisely annihilates any possible infalling particles and restores the local vacuum and the geometric interpretation of this flow I'm constructing. But you want to speak it, this is the Bok intuition for what this U is, but what is the special property of this U in the CFT? Okay, so to get to the statement, I need three steps. I hope I won't lose you during these three steps. Three is, I believe, the minimal number of steps for any non-trivial statement. So I'll do my best to explain them clearly. So what we'll do is we will consider kind of the larger class, all states that we obtain from psi by acting with an arbitrary unitary U. That, of course, the unitary is constrained to act within this subspace type of interest. Then we'll take some operator near the black hole at some initial moment in time, and we'll flow it with a modular flow of the general state. And we will build this kind of guy, the modular flowed operator. Now, we will also define one more notion. The extra notion is a notion of complexity, the complexity of the excitation of interest. And we will define this as a difference between two state complexities, put an asterisk on state complexity for now. It is the complexity of the state psi with the excitation of this modular float guy minus the complexity of the state without the excitation. What I mean here by complexity of states is, this is usually is a quantum information theoretic notion. It is usually defined as the number of kind of elementary operations one needs to perform in order to start from some reference state, let's say the vacuum, and get to the state, the target state, the state we're interested in. And of course, there's an ambiguity. The result of this complexity will depend on the choices one makes of what elementary operations are and what the reference state to use. But parametrically, this notion seems to be fairly robust. And there are prescriptions for relating this type of notion of complexity to Bok quantities, like a measure of the volume of the Bok universe that we can get more precise about. So we define now the complexity of an excitation as the excess state complexity that it introduces when we excite the state with it. The statement that I'm making and the justification of that is a bit subtle, and I'm happy to discuss it afterwards, is that the equilibrium modular, the equilibrium unitary, these special states that have geometric modular flows are the ones that minimize that excitation complexity when this modular flow time, remember there's a parameter here, which depends on how much we flow it, becomes the scrambling time. The scrambling time of my little black hole observer, the logarithm of the entropy of my little black hole. Now, there are a number of arguments supporting this case. There's no proof, right? It's a conjecture. There's a number of arguments supporting this case. I have a slide with the main geometric arguments, but I will just give you some very brief intuition for it. The brief intuition comes from studying the properties of this modular flow. So there's two elements that go in. The first element is an argument that explains why when this modular flow is an equilibrium modular flow, a local vacuum modular flow, then this state here is built up by a time ordered operator product, whereas when this K is a non-equilibrium state, this excited state contains an out of time ordered product of operators. And this out-of-time ordered product of operators in chaotic theories generally produce states of larger complexity. There's, of course, more precise statements one can make. I just want to give you the general intuition that the properties of this modular flow produce out-of-time ordered products when we are out of equilibrium. And that is the key that we're using for diagnosing the local vacuum. Okay, this is the most technical this talk becomes. This is the precise statement. And I want to now get back to the bigger picture and sort of take stock what we have accomplished so far. Given a code subspace, which is really a code word for a picking a geometric background and the QFT Hilbert space on top of it in the CFT, I have given you the rule for selecting, or at least given you a rule for selecting a special class of states, which I called local equilibrium states, whose modular flow, I argued, is geometric. And what do they act? It's geometric in the near the probe that we have. And it generates proper time translation along the probe's trajectory. And this prescription continues to be well-defined in the black hole interior. It's entirely phrased in the CFT, and it is well-defined in black hole interior. So what can we learn from it? And I believe I have 3 minutes, which is just enough for me to say what we can learn from it. What can we learn from it? Well, we can actually go back to the original questions that we wanted to answer. We can now start with the CFT and just initiate it in some kind of black hole state we like, and introduce the observer using this little wormhole operator that I explained in the beginning without giving you much details, and then construct the equilibrium modular flow and obtain observables everywhere along the trajectory of this small infalling black hole. There's a few obvious things now that you, a few obvious questions that you may ask. Well, clearly the singularity will be reached in finite proper time. So can you get a signature of the singularity? Well, that's a question we asked in our paper, and we set up the question and we observe the following. So from the bulk point of view, what do we expect? What do we expect from the kind of bulk QFT analysis to see? Well, there seems to be a universal signature of the singularity approach in the bulk. So and a degree of freedom, this time-translated field, as it approaches the singularity, its correlation functions with boundary operators, even space-like separated ones, they exhibit a logarithmic divergence. They diverge logarithmically as a function of logarithmically in the distance, the Schwarzschild distance from the singularity. So there exists a finite tau, this is the modular time tau, at which the bulk computation diverges. But this computation has absolutely no reason to diverge in any finite n CFT. It's just a perfectly fine correlation function, nothing ill-defined about it. So this divergence that you get from the bulk singularity is a consequence of taking the appropriate large n limit. So what we do in our paper is we set up this computation. We don't perform it in the CFT, but by performing that computation we were able to set up, we may be able to get a precise, we may be able to get a hint of the resolution of an aspect of the black hole singularity. This is project for the future number one. Project for the future number two is, well, now you can actually start playing more interesting games, because the amount of proper time that it takes for an observer to hit the singularity is kind of a measure of the size of the interior. If this proper time coincides with the proper time expected to reach the horizon, then there's no interior. Whereas if you have the general relativity solution, then there's a precise value of this tau d. So now you may ask actually indirectly questions that have been sort of troubling the community for quite some time, which is, if I take a typical black hole microstate, go to some Hilbert space of fixed energy and pick at random with a higher measure some microstate of black hole, some black hole microstate, does this black hole microstate have an interior, a macroscopic interior, or does it not? So you can actually, by having this first measure, by having computed the proper time at which the singularity appears, you can actually do statistics of this measure now. You can ask, what is the average of this measure over the Hilbert space or its variance? And that sheds light onto the firewall problem. But of course, you can ask also more precise questions, like, for example, what is the expectation value of a particular operator somewhere in the interior in some black hole microstate? Interestingly, it's the last question that we actually made technical progress on first. This is in a paper that I wrote with Ping Gao last year. We did this computation in SYK, which is the simplest holographic system we could come up with, where we performed this procedure as described, the introduction of the observer by this wormhole operator, the construction of the modular flow. We do all these computations in SYK, and we measure the expectation value of an interior field in some excited black hole state. And we actually get on-the-nose agreement with the bulk expectation in this case. So the other two questions are a bit more technically difficult. But the key point I want to emphasize, and I will end with this, is that both of these questions were confusing at the conceptual level before. Namely, there existed no precise technical computation whose answer would illuminate them because of the absence of a CFT definition of the interior observables. At least, well, the reason why I'm optimistic with this work is that at least I can now write down a correlation function, which if I'm powerful enough to compute, I will be able to learn something about these questions. And I'm going to leave you with this. And thanks for your attention.
Okay. Let's thank Lampros for an interesting talk. And if there are questions, please raise your hand and we'll go in order. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah. Thanks for the great talk, Lampros. I have, I guess, a few different questions, but I'll just pick one. So, maybe starting with one of the last things you said, which was about this two-point function you have under point one here. Should probe the singularity. So, I guess first of all, just to clarify, the operator O here. Oh, I see. That's just whatever operator. So phi on the left is like the flow version of O.
Yeah. Phi is the float version of some initial of this O over here.
Yeah.
This O is unmarked because it can be any operator on the right. So if you go too far in a boundary time, this ends up starting decaying exponentially, as you would expect, because you know this is sort of the overlap of an excited interior state with an exterior state. So with an exterior excitation, and this decays by quasi-normal decay. So this O can be any operator, even space-like separated, as long as you don't go too far into the future of the boundary time.
I see. And then I guess on that point, there's also, I think there's been some revisiting of this older paper by like Veronica Hubany and Steve Shanker, where they were proposing that some kind of, I think they were looking at two-sided black holes, and there was some kind of two-point function, like with operators on either side, and some I guess analytic continuation of one of these two-point functions was supposed to probe these geodesics that like go near the singularity.
Yeah.
Is there any relationship between these proposals, or?
That's a good question. I don't know if there's a relationship. I mean, assuming that both of them probe the singularity, which there's good reasons to believe they do, then there should be some kind of relation, but it's certainly not obvious. You see, Their description seems mathematically correct, but it's not very physically illuminating because you start with a two-point function between the two boundaries, then you go to frequency space, and then you kind of analytically continue to imaginary frequencies, and you go to the second branch, to the second sheet of this correlation function, and there you have some kind of exponential decay at large imaginary frequencies. Now, that's very interesting, of course, but do we learn something from it about what exactly how the singularity manifests itself in the CFT? It's questionable. So it would be interesting if somehow you can relate that mathematical property of two-sided correlation functions to this divergence we see here, or we expect here. We don't see it, I should emphasize. We didn't do the CFT computation. We expect it from the bulk version. It will be very interesting. I don't see a direct path into to linking these two approaches, but of course, you know.
Yeah, I mean, this certainly feels more closely related to some physical picture than this like weird analytically continued thing. But
I mean, it could be that they're different languages of probing the same idea, but yeah, I can't see the connection at this point. But I'll have to dive into the CFT computation of this quantity more deeply to have a comment on that.
Yeah. Thanks.
I do want to point out that we did set up the computation, and you know, it looks daunting, but it doesn't look completely out of the question. I mean, that would take a little bit longer to explain, but it amounts to computing a particular Euclidean path integral and then hope to analytically continue it in some parameter. And the Euclidean path integral, we actually write it down in the paper. And the data that comes into that Euclidean path integral seem to be within reach. So there may be something that one can do here. It's not completely hopeless.
Nice, yeah.
Which is the best I could hope for about the statement for the black hole singularity. Yeah.
Are there other questions for Lampros on the presentation? If not, let's thank Lampros again.